You're listening to Washington Post Live's First Look podcast with Jonathan Capehart.
Welcome to First Look, Washington Post Live's one-stop shop for news and analysis. I'm Jonathan Capehart, associate editor at the Washington Post. Well, after an Israeli airstrike that killed 7 aid workers with World Central Kitchen, President Biden finally had that come-to-Jesus talk yesterday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he was caught on a hot mic telling senators he would have after his State of the Union address last month. One of the things Biden told Bibi was that, an immediate ceasefire is essential. A focal point of how Netanyahu has been executing his war on Hamas has been the Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza. Hours before special forces with the Israel Defense Forces withdrew, a handful of foreign journalists were allowed in. William Booth, London Bureau Chief for the Washington Post, was one of them, and he joins us now from Jerusalem. William, welcome to First Look.
Nice to be here, Jonathan.
Thank you. So you went into Al-Shifa on Monday, and the lead of the story, you and Lorenzo Tugnoli, really sets the scene. I want to read it. Gaza's largest hospital has been gutted. Combat bulldozers have moved sand into the courtyards. The buildings are scorched. It smells like death. Israeli commandos pulled out before dawn on Monday. Tell us more of what you saw.
They took us in a couple of APCs, armored personnel carrier devices. We didn't see a thing going into Gaza from the Berry kibbutz on the edge. All of a sudden, we emerge. There we are, right at the hospital. Israeli special forces soldiers rush us up to the third and fourth floor. We have a look down at the hospital. And what we saw at the hospital, I'd been to Al-Shifa many times in the past, not recently, but during my past time here. And it was gutted. It was gone. There is no functioning Al-Shifa hospital anymore. Those scenes you're seeing right now are former courtyards, plants, people, parking, entry room, lobby, waiting room, what would kind of look like an American-style hospital, right? And that is not there anymore.
You know, there is a gulf between Israelis and Palestinians and how the hospital is viewed. The Israelis describe it as a command center for terrorists, while, as you write, quote, the hospital has served as a beacon or refuge and resilience for the Palestinians. Did you see evidence to support both of these views?
No, I didn't on this one trip. We didn't see a single Palestinian. We came in, the area had been under intense urban combat fighting for 14 days. There were no Palestinian civilians when we were there. You could see from video they came in the next day after the Israeli special forces left, but we didn't see any patients, any doctors. We just saw Israeli special forces on this trip in. The IDF has put out photos of mortars and rifles and some documents and other things. And earlier they showed reporters like tunnels under Shifa. But on this trip, what we saw is just the video that you just presented, just the hospital as it is today.
Mm-hmm. William, let's talk more about the airstrike on the 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen. A report was released by the IDF today, taking responsibility, talking about how two people, I believe, were relieved of their command who were held responsible for this. The World Central Kitchen founder, Chef Jose Andres, penned an op-ed that was in the New York Times where he called it a deliberate attack, especially since the organization says it coordinated its movements with the Israeli army. What's your reporting revealed about this strike?
Like, at minimum, it's a tremendous screw-up. The IDF just released a report, just as you mentioned, a few hours ago, again apologizing, again saying that was a grievous mistake, it was tragic. But they do say that they saw two gunmen kind of around the aid vehicles. And it's clear that they were striking these aid vehicles, and they hit them like three times. And they don't have like a great answer for how they made that decision to hit those. those three vehicles. I think the World Kitchen, World Central Kitchen people, it's correct that their cars were targeted, and the IDF apologizes for that. But the explanation of why they targeted these three cars and who the IDF thought was in these vehicles when they hit them is still like a little mushy from the Israeli side. But seven people are dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'm sitting here, you know, ever since the news of what happened to the seven aid workers, and I've been struggling with this tension. On the one hand, the Israel Defense Forces are considered among the most sophisticated in the world. And yet we're supposed to believe that they make mistake after mistake after mistake in terms of hitting civilian targets or even hitting a humanitarian aid convoy that is coordinating with its own forces.
Yes. So your question is the spot on question, Jonathan. The sophisticated military, which has drones and observation and intelligence and eyes in the sky and all these other things, can do something this stupid or this reckless, demonstrates that they're not that they make mistakes and maybe they make way too many mistakes. They've hit tons of civilians, as we know. But this one was a clear example to the outside world what they're capable of getting wrong.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot has happened since that phone call yesterday between the president and the prime minister. Border crossings are opening for aid relief. Rules of engagement are apparently changing. What else is your reporting show? Was the phone call as terse and tense as the president promised it would be when he was caught on that hot mic?
I think it, the White House readout was that it was terse and tense. I wasn't on the phone call, but I think it, you see from the Israeli side that they immediately are opening up more corridors for aid, something that the Americans and others would argue they should have done weeks or months ago. So that is happening now. New rules of engagement are necessary and should have been put out a long time ago. I mean, I think Biden laid down the law. I think Biden and Netanyahu, Bibi, as you mentioned him, I mean, I think they know each other from a long time. But I think the president is increasingly frustrated. The American public's increasingly frustrated. Biden voters are increasingly frustrated that this things like the World Central Kitchen strike continues to happen. And that one got so much attention because obviously it was an aid convoy. And I'm not saying because it had foreigners in it, but because it was an aid convoy. And these kinds of strikes happen often. Mm-hmm. In Israel. In Gaza. It's a dirty, messy war. And mm-hmm. we've seen the figures from the Palestinian side. I think Biden told Netanyahu, you really, really need to start doing something that I can at least give me, I don't know, cover or change this. But you need to start doing enough that I can continue to have your back.
Well, the one thing that the strike on World Central Kitchen has that other hits on convoys did not have, and that is the founder of World Central Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres, and the president are friends. And the president, remember when the president went to Ukraine, he went to World Central Kitchen's refugee feeding setup. So they know each other very well. The president goes to Chef Jose's restaurants here in Washington all the time. One more question for you, William, and this is a very important question before I let you go. What does the call between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu mean for Netanyahu's planned invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza, which Biden told me last month would be a red line for him?
You know, Netanyahu has described the upcoming, what he says is upcoming, offensive into Rafah as, you know, existential, that they cannot win the war without going into Rafah and wiping out the last elements of Hamas and getting hostages that they believe are in the tunnels and killing Hamas leaders down in Rafah. He compares it to the Allied forces leaving German troops on the ground in World War II and not going into Berlin. So that's the kind of rhetoric he uses. Will they go into Rafah the way that Netanyahu wants them to go, or go in a softer way, or do it more at the edges, or as the U.S. military has pushed them to do much more strategic strikes? That's to be seen. But if a strategic strike looks like what they did to Al-Shifa, you know, critics of the Israeli policy say that that doesn't look so good.
William Booth, London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, coming to us from Jerusalem. Thank you very much for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Anytime, Jonathan.
And time for the Opinions Roundtable. So let's go to the opinion side of The Washington Post, where we will find Washington Post columnists Max Boot and Josh Rogan. Max, Josh, welcome back to First Look.
Great to be back.
Good to be here.
All right. This is a question for both of you. I would love to know, do you think the killing of the seven World Central Kitchen aid workers and the subsequent phone call between the president and the prime minister mark a turning point in the Israel-Hamas war? Max, you go first.
Well, really hard to say, Jonathan, because there's certainly been a lot of things that Israel has done that have greatly offended President Biden, and even more so greatly offended much of U.S. public opinion, and the Biden administration has signaled its displeasure and yet has kept on sending weapons, including a new sale of bombs to Israel. And so there's been kind of a disconnect between the rhetorical displeasure voiced by the administration and the actions of the administration vis-a-vis Israel. So is this actually going to be a turning point? Will Biden actually turn the screws on Bibi and make him pay a real price if he disregards American warnings about trying to limit collateral damage, about trying to get aid and food into Gaza? Or will, it'll be business pretty much as usual. It's really hard to predict at this point.
Josh?
I'm not optimistic that this will result in any big change in either the U.S. policy or the Israeli policy for that matter. I mean, just look at what the White House announced. They didn't say they're going to use pressure against the Netanyahu government. They said they're threatened to use pressure in exchange. Israel promised to do something that the White House has been asking them to do for months, and nothing about the Rafah coming invasion, nothing about the greater humanitarian situation and the real cause of why there is 1.1 million people facing catastrophic food insecurity in northern Gaza. It's not for a lack of access points, okay? The Israelis can announce as many access points as they want, but the truth is that there are thousands of trucks sitting right now at the access points that are already open that can't get in because of policies that the Israeli government has instituted that amount to barriers for aid delivery and an onerous and arbitrary inspection process that rejects things like scissors and child's medical kits. Sleeping bags, if they're the color green, that's a real example. Dates, if they have pits in them, as if the pits are going to be some sort of threat to the Israeli forces. And this is a comprehensive system of aid denial that, for which every aid group says, has been getting worse, not better. So it seems like what the White House has done is come up with a way to get through the next news cycle, not to actually solve the problem of the catastrophic humanitarian situation, especially in northern Gaza. And everybody knows that the White House and the president have been dragged into this by pressure from inside their party and around the world because of the just sheer horror of the a reality of a man-made famine in 2024 in a place where there's no shortage of food. So, no, I'm not optimistic. I think this is a exercise in damage control for both the Biden administration and the Israelis, and the situation on the ground is actually only getting worse, tragically.
Wow. Max, I would love to get your reaction. Are you as pessimistic as Josh? Do you see what happened in terms of the phone call and the readouts and everything as an exercise in damage control, as Josh does?
Yeah, primarily, but I think it is possible that Biden will get tougher because it's possible that he may be finally coming to the end of his string with Netanyahu, and it wouldn't take much. I mean, all he would have to do would be to delay the next U.S. military aid shipment to Israel, and that would send a very clear message. I think the fundamental problem that Israel confronts in Gaza, which is very different from the problem that the Allies confronted in Germany in 1945, which, as William noted, is the analogy that Bibi loves to use all the time. The fundamental problem is that the fundamental difference is that in 1945, the Allies had a plan for what to do in Germany after the defeat of the Nazis. They had an occupation regime that they were ready to implement, leading to the eventual creation of East and West Germany and a democratic West Germany and so forth and so on. The fundamental problem in Gaza right now, and this is something that Biden has been and his folks have been talking about for months, is that Israel still does not have a day after plan. And that certainly contributes to some of the horrors that you're seeing in Gaza right now. Part of the problem, as Josh said, is that the Israelis are withholding a lot of food shipments. But the even larger problem, I think, is that even when food gets into or medicine gets into Gaza, it's very hard to distribute it, because what the Israelis have basically done is they have destroyed or come close to destroying Hamas control over much of the Gaza Strip, but they have not created any kind of administration to replace Gaza in the way that there was, for example, U.S. military administration or British military administration in Germany. There is nothing like that in Gaza. The Israeli military is not administering Gaza. Nobody is administering Gaza. It's becoming basically Mogadishu on the Mediterranean, and Netanyahu has not come up with any real long-term plan for governing for anybody, whether it's the Palestinian Authority or the IDF or anybody or local, Gaza civilians, anybody to govern Gaza. And so I think you're going to see the problems continue to get worse because of the nature of the Israeli government, which is very right-wing. And so they can't, allow Palestinian Authority administration in Gaza, but they also don't want Israeli military administration. And so basically it's going to be this lawless area, which is going to be a disaster for its people. It's going to be a disaster for Israel. And that's a point that I think Biden and Blinken and others have been making, and Bibi is just not listening to it because he doesn't actually care about the long-term future of Gaza or Israel. All he cares about is his political survival.
Well, let me stick with you, Max, because you were recently in Egypt, and you wrote a column this week that the only way the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can end is for a leader like former Egyptian President Anwar Sadat to emerge. But Max, does such a leader even exist in the region today? Who could that be?
Well, I don't have any candidates, sadly, Jonathan. I mean, that was kind of the point of the column, that there is not an obvious Sadat figure. But, if you want a small sliver of hope, when, Sadat took over in 1970 from Nasser in Egypt, nobody imagined the kind of revolution that Sadat would bring about over the course of the next decade. First launching the Yom Kippur War against Israel, but then making peace with Israel and making his dramatic journey to Jerusalem in 1977. To address the Knesset and to leading to the breakthroughs in the Camp David peace accord. So I'm not suggesting that anything like that is remotely likely. I'm just saying that is what it will take to end this endless cycle of violence between Israelis and Palestinians, which has only become horrifyingly worse since October 7th. And unfortunately, right now, you have terrible leadership on both sides with, Netanyahu, as I mentioned, is all about political survival, doesn't really seem to care what happens to Israel or the Palestinians in the long term. On the other side, you have Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, who's pushing 90 years old and, who's 19 years into a four-year term, has no credibility, no support. And then that creates an opening for the fanatics of Hamas. My only hope is that, that Israel will be able to vastly reduce the power of Hamas, and perhaps Netanyahu and Abbas will leave the stage in the next few years, and maybe, just maybe, there's an outside shot that their successors will do better. It's not a likelihood. I'm just saying that that's what it would take to end this.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Josh, you wrote a column voicing concern about how Donald Trump may shift U.S. policy in this war based on recent remarks by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. What did he say that worries you?
Right. I'll get to Jared's remarks in a second, but just to very quickly respond to what Max said, I think there's a lot of chatter in Washington about what happens the day after the war politically, but that we sort of look right past the effects of the devastation and catastrophic humanitarian situation on the ground today is going to have on that calculation. I mean, let's remember that, you know, more than half of Gazans starving right now are children. And they're the ones that are going to be the generation that's going to live side by side with the Israelis for the next 50 years. And what are they going to take out of this experience other than the belief that they have very little choice but to lead a life of resistance? So we can look at it as a top-down problem, but we can also look at it as a bottom-up problem because the sheer devastation that is involved in having a million people starve for no lack of food but lack of access of humanitarian aid not only has effects for Palestinians but for Israelis and for the region and for the United States, which purports to be a guarantor of a world where man-made famines in 2024 just shouldn't happen. And what leg do we have to stand on when criticizing Vladimir Putin or Bashar al-Assad when they use a weapon of war if we allow this situation to continue under the watch of our allies? So I just think that, I'd like to sort of just focus on that. Now, Jared Kushner, I think very clumsily stumbled into this debate because he was giving a talk at his alma mater, Harvard, in February, and he said a lot of crazy things. And, you know, one of the things that he said was that, hey, well, you know, Gaza is not a real historical construct, and, you know, borders change all the time in war, and if borders change this time, no big deal, and why don't the Arabs take them, and this kind of stuff, you know. And that very conveniently dovetails with the opinions about Gaza in the farthest right part of the Netanyahu coalition, which where ministers and officials are openly now calling for the resettlement of Gaza by Israelis, confirming what essentially is what at least invokes in a lot of people's minds ethnic cleansing. And that's what Jared said. He said the Israelis should move them out and clean it up. Now, when I talked to Jared Kushner about this, he said that's not what he meant. He was just saying move them out temporarily, and then, you know, after the Hamas is gone, maybe they can come back, maybe not. But this just shows you that, you know, with all the criticism that people have on a humanitarian scale for the Biden administration's policy, and again, I share a lot of that criticism, Trump administration could be worse. It could be a lot worse if they start to align themselves. Now, that's not to say Jared's going to be in that administration. He says he won't. We'll have to see if it ever happens. But this is the way that the Trump people, many people in Trump world think, that, you know, let's just align ourselves with the far right parts of the Netanyahu coalition and see what happens. And that would be devastating because it would undermine all of the sort of U.S.-led policy, which insists for very simple reason that Gazans have a right to live on their own land, and and that the war can only end with Gazans retaining their original borders. And I think that the U.S. support for that only survives as long as the Biden administration does.
All right, let's switch gears.
Josh is right. If I could just add one fast point. I mean, Josh is right, but the entertaining and amusing thing for me to see is that recently Trump has actually been pretty critical of Netanyahu, saying that he needs to wrap up the war. It looks very bad. And apparently, as far as anybody can tell, the explanation is that Trump is pissed off at Netanyahu because Bibi congratulated Biden on his victory in the 2020 election. So it's a reminder that for Trump, all politics is personal, and there is no consistency or rationality to many of his so-called policy positions.
Yeah, well, that is the consistency, that it's all about him. He doesn't want the war to last until his term because he doesn't want to deal with it, and he doesn't really care what happens. So I think that's a level of consistency in a sense.
Yeah, and another consistency is that he also thinks it's a PR problem for Israel and for Netanyahu. All right, let's talk about the Russia's war on Ukraine, Max, because in an interview with CBS News last week, Ukrainian President Zelensky told CBS, and I want to quote, "We have stabilized the situation. It is better than it used to be 2 or 3 months ago when we had a big deficit of artillery ammunition, different kinds of weapons," he said. "We totally didn't see the big, huge counteroffensive from Russia. They didn't have success." So, Max, is Russia really winning its war on Ukraine?
I would not say that Russia is winning its war in Ukraine right now, Jonathan, but I'm very concerned that Russia could win the war in Ukraine if the U.S. does not resume aid. I think there is a massive shell hunger, as Ukrainian troops put it, on the front lines. The Russians are using artillery at a rate of something like 5-1 compared to the Ukrainians, and there are widespread expectations that the Russians will mount a summer offensive. And I think there is very real fear in Kyiv that the Russians could break through the Ukrainian lines, because brave as the Ukrainian defenders are, they still need ammunition to stop the Russian assault, and they're running very low on ammunition. I think really the fate of Ukraine, the fate of Europe and the world, not to be overly dramatic, I think all of that turns on the decisions of MAGA Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House. And is he going to bring up the Ukraine aid bill for a vote? And he's been, you know, for 6 months or so, he's been doing a bait and switch where he keeps giving interviews saying, oh, he's very sympathetic to the idea of aid to Ukraine, but there's like some, and then whatever the latest excuse is for not bringing the bill to a vote. And then, you know, during the recess, he said it's going to come up right after the Easter recess. Now he's saying maybe mid-April, maybe a little bit later. We'll see what happens. But this is really an existential issue for Ukraine and really a massive issue for U.S. security and European security as well. And it's in the hands of this guy with very little track record knowledge and almost no majority in the House. So this is a real cause for concern.
Mm-hmm. And on that point about this being cause for concern for U.S. security, in that same interview, Josh, Zelensky warned, quote, Putin's army can come to Europe and then the citizens of the United States. This threat has been present since the start of the war, but is that more or less of a possibility today?
Right. No, I agree with everything that Max said. I don't think that Vladimir Putin has any plans to attack NATO or Europe anytime soon. He's pretty busy, you know, in Ukraine. But that doesn't mean that if Ukraine loses, he wouldn't then turn to NATO and Europe as his next choice, because appeasement emboldens the aggressor every single time throughout history. It's the thing that we should have learned from the last century that we're forced to learn again this century at the cost of thousands of Ukrainian lives, and that's a tragedy. But it definitely has implications for Asia as well. And if you just, you know, next week, the Japanese prime minister is coming to town. And that's what he's going to say. He's going to say, we can't give up on Ukraine, because that would signal to China that might makes right and democracies can be crushed and the United States won't be there, and that we don't have the credibility to stand up for the things that we believe in. When it comes to Mike Johnson, you know, I agree with Max. He's been playing this sort of shell game with the MAGA folks and with the DC establishment, telling them both what they want to hear. My sources tell me that now that, you know, in a ironic way, now that Marjorie Taylor Greene has made her move and put his speakership in jeopardy, that's the thing that convinced Johnson and his staff that they might as well go ahead with the Ukraine, because she actually gave up her leverage and they realized they can't appease her and that she, you know, you just can't negotiate with crazy. So I think that actually tipped the scales. And what my sources tell me is that he's tasked Republican chairman to write a new Ukraine bill. He's not going to do the Senate package, which has Israel and Taiwan stuff. They're writing it now, and it's not done. That's why it's not out yet. And it will have a lot of Ukraine aid. It won't be the same as the Senate bill. It's likely to have some additional sanctions. It's likely to have language calling for Russian assets to be seized. And it's likely to have a lot of weapons that the Biden administration maybe doesn't want to give them, as sort of like, oh, Biden's too weak. And it's like they have a lot less economic and humanitarian aid, which may or may not end up being in a loan form per Donald Trump's suggestion. That's what I'm hearing as of this moment. That's all subject to change. But the point is, a Ukraine bill is coming in the House. And I think the White House and Senate Democrats are hoping that it's good enough that they can just swallow it, that it won't be too bad, that they can just pass it. And I think there's a lane there, narrow as it is, where Johnson puts forward a Ukraine bill that everyone can sort of get behind. That only gets you to the end of the year. And then, you know, once the presidential election happens, if the Trump administration comes back in, all bets are off.
All right, Max, I'm going to give you the last word, because I think we've got maybe 90 seconds left. But given what Josh just said, I'm just sitting here wondering, is Speaker Johnson, the effort he's going through now, having a whole new bill written up, is this a serious effort, or is this just a political exercise on his part?
Oh, 100% political exercise. I mean, if he were serious about helping Ukraine, he would just call a vote tomorrow on the aid bill that passed with 70 votes in the Senate, and the aid would start flowing. I mean, all of this is basically designed to placate the MAGA base, which, as Josh suggested, ultimately cannot be placated. But, you know, I think the White House position is that they're going to give Johnson some running room just to see if they can get some kind of bill out of the House. The problem is, of course, that as they're writing their own bill, they're wasting more time, and Ukraine does not have any time to spare. Ukrainians are dying every single day, and the cost to Ukraine of not getting this U.S. aid are increasing, and the risk that Ukraine will suffer a catastrophic defeat this summer, all of that is increasing while, you know, Johnson is hemming and hawing and trying to figure out some way to satisfy the MAGA extremists in the House.
Yeah, they are rationing bullets on the Ukrainian side. Just bring it into the real world. Max Boot, Josh Rogan, as always, thank you both very much for coming to First Look. Have a good weekend.
Happy Friday.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To always stay up to date with the series, subscribe to Washington Post Live's First Look on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.